At Makua Beach on the west side of Oahu, people with nowhere else to go found sanctuary. The push and pull factors, the reasons why they were living on the beach, were many. Chronic illness, houselessness, PTSD, debt, a rejection of and by the new economy dominated by tourism and the military, an insistence on political self-determination for a community at the margins, a need for spiritual healing through connecting with the Aina, with the abundant lands and waters of Makua. Most of the families and individuals living at Makua were Kanaka Maoli, or Native Hawaiian. The village at Makua Beach was a community of mutual care, of collective rehabilitation, of living in close relationship with the land. Over the decades, the beach was a home for multiple self-organized communities, some with hundreds of residents. In the mid-90s, there were some 60 households at Makua who built homes from pallets and tent material on the beach. They grew vegetables and harvested the abundance of the sea. Some commuted to jobs and children attended school. A stone's throw away from the beach, across a two-lane highway, lies Makua Valley, which the U.S. Army held and continues to hold as the Makua Military Reservation. Starting in World War II, the U.S. Army conducted heavy live-fire training in Makua, destroying the homes of the community evicted under martial law, as well as the old church, and turning the valley into a minefield of unexploded ordnance. The use of live munitions often led to uncontrolled fires, which burned through the valley as firefighters watched from outside the gate, unable to enter safely due to the unexploded bombs in the ground. Shortly after Hawaii became a state, the Army acquired a 65-year lease to continue using Makua Valley and other lands for a token fee of $1. Of these two uses of the land situated on either side of Farrington Highway, the state of Hawaii considered one to be an illegal occupation.
During the eviction, we were arrested, and they came in with bulldozers and bulldozed all the homes, scraped up the big pieces and left the broken glass and the splinters and all of the stuff in the sand and just covered it up.
In June of 1996, 100-some state agents descended onto Makua Beach and destroyed the homes of the almost 300 people living there. 16 people were arrested. I'm Kenji Cataldo, and you're listening to Before Us, a new audio documentary podcast about U.S. empire and grassroots movements for peace and liberation. In this first season, Makua Pico of Peace, we're diving into the story of Makua Valley and the demilitarization movement in Hawaii. Since I first heard the story of the eviction at Makua Beach, I've been trying to understand the unfolding history that made this scenario possible. What led to a Hawaii where a community of Hawaiians with nowhere else to go was evicted from a beach in their native land, while the military of a nation across the Pacific bombed and polluted and desecrated the valley across the road with impunity? As a citizen of that nation across the Pacific, I felt I needed to know what is being done in the name of national security, in the name of my security, using my tax dollars. How did the Army come to use Makua for training? What were the costs of that training, and who paid them? How does the U.S. military's presence in Hawaii affect land and housing for the local community? What was in the valley before the Army, and what could the valley be in the future? Over the past 4 years, I've been recording interviews with activists, community members, scholars, and even an Army colonel about Makua. I've looked back through archival footage and documented recent developments in real time as they've unfolded. Through this process, I've become directly involved in the work of Malama Makua, the organization most prominent in the movement for the return and restoration of Makua since the 90s. It's through Malama Makua, and in particular, Uncle Sparky Rodriguez, Auntie Lynette Cruz, and Uncle Vince Dodge, that I have come to know Makua and get involved. The story of Malama Makua is a central focus for this podcast, but it's definitely not the only story of Makua, and Malama Makua is not the only group with a connection to Makua. This podcast tells just one part of a much larger, ongoing story of this Aina. Full disclosure, I'm not Hawaiian, and I'm not from the West Side. I'm a mixed-race Asian American born in Japan and raised in Minnesota, which is the homelands of the Dakota Nation. At the same time, I'm also not a disinterested observer. I'm committed to supporting the return of Makua and the land back movement in Hawaii. If you want to know more about who I am, what I do, and why, check out the extra episode about the producer at the end of the feed where I speak to my positionality. This first episode tells the story of how Malama Makua came to be and is dedicated to Auntie Leandra Wai and Uncle Fred Dodge, two foundational figures in the formation of Malama Makua, who passed on in 2016 and 2022, respectively. Part 1, The Beach. Our story begins at Makua Beach. This is the Makua that many know and love, a peaceful camping spot far from town where you can see dolphins and turtles. The waters are rich with fish and limu or seaweed. The beach is lined with kiawe trees laden with sweet bean pods and bristling with sharp thorns. From the 1960s through the mid-90s, Makua Beach was a pu'uhonua, a sanctuary, for multiple village communities that were disrupted by hurricanes as well as police sweeps and evictions. In the early 80s, Makua was home to a self-organized fishing community who declared their right to live there as citizens, not of the U.S., but of the nation of Hawaii. An eviction in 1983 saw bulldozers destroying the fishers' homes as the community and its supporters protested. Five people were arrested. By the 90s, a new community had formed. Houseless families and individuals built homes on the beach.
So I first started with the homeless group out in Makua. It's part of the what is called the Makua Council.
That's Uncle Sparky Rodriguez, a founding member of Malama Makua.
We were looking for a long-term solution to home, for homelessness. But it was more than that, because my wife and I had been separated, sort of. And we were on the Kahana Haiki side of Makua. And the goal was to use the aina to heal the relationship that we had.
In the 90s, when Auntie Leandra began staying out at Makua Beach, there was a community of almost 300 people, mostly Kanaka Maoli, living there.
And during that time, the whole place had homeless or houseless. Majority were Hawaiian. And she ended up selecting a place that was more Wahine energy. And she ended up building a holiday there, a tent, a kitchen, a place to sleep. And then she started her pohaku gathering and doing her art and her connection to the aina. So her interest was about how do I heal. She didn't know that at the beginning, and neither did I. So backstory for her, she comes out of Kalihi Valley housing. And that traumatic part of growing up in the housing environment is challenging.
While Auntie Leandra grew up in public housing in Kalihi, Uncle Sparky was born and raised in Kaimuki. He would spend summers with his grandmother in Makaha, just a short ways from Makua, where he first heard the live fire training happening in the valley.
So while we were in the, at night sleeping, boom, house would shake, the windows would rattle. And she had the old type, slide up wooden type windows, and they would rattle. And that's, from dead sleep to up because of the explosions that was happening in Makua.
Uncle Sparky went on to work in his father's auto repair business before being drafted to fight in the Vietnam War. He returned from Vietnam in 1971, eventually meeting Auntie Leandra and moving out to Lualualei in Waianae. It was a long process of healing for both of them that led Auntie Leandra to live out at Makua Beach while Uncle Sparky stayed at home with the kids. Auntie Leandra had gone through a significant personal loss.
At that point, she was really impacted emotionally, spiritually. It's just like, you know, the whole world was just destroyed. And not because of anything specific, but I believe there was something in her soul that was missing in the relationship, in her life. And, you know, how do I fill that space? So she started looking, various religious experiences. Her friends would take her. She went to the Stonehenge. And then throughout Germany, France, went to Japan, looking for this healing. And then ultimately she came back, and when she set up her Hali, that was the space, the Wahine space, that started her healing journey. And we stopped looking beyond for outside help and started looking within. So Kahana Haiki really helped us with that. Learning about ourselves, learning about each other, and then connecting to the Aina. So that was really the beginning of our Makua effort. She had already started before me by being there. And a lot of it she did on her own. So it's not talking to anyone, but just being there with your thoughts, your feelings, emotions, and then talking to the Aina and having the Kupuna kind of guide you.
Here's Auntie Leandra herself from a 1996 documentary, Makua to Heal a Nation.
Our feelings of love and connectedness to the land are beginning to rise, and we need a place to go, and we got to start here. And Makua is crying for us to come home. And it was a garbage dump. I was really torn between running away and staying, but I had no place else to go. So I built. And as I started to build mine, I started to realize that everyone here had basically a common reason for coming down here. Life had shattered in one way or another. And I had no idea, this land, this water, I hated water. I was scared of water. But I find myself right next door to it, and it's awesome. Something about the soil or the sand here or the salt air makes fruit sweeter and beans sweeter. I mean, everything is sweet. And we're healing our past of torment and destruction. And many of us are beginning to rake the land, and we're beginning to uncover things that was here before. And within that, we're finding our connection.
Well, I met Leandra. So Sparky's wife, Leandra, I met her on the beach in 95. And I used to spend a lot of time down on the beach, down in her place. She had a beautiful place.
That voice is another integral member of Malama Makua.
My name is Vince Kana'i Dodge. Yeah, it was interesting. You know, I think she's the one that said, you know, the beach is a microcosm. There's everything on this beach. You know, there's people that just love living on the beach. You know, maybe they moved because they didn't have any place for a while, but now they just totally love it. And there are people that are totally strung out on drugs, don't have any other place to go. You know, people that crap right outside the door of their tent. And people that plant and groom and create and make beauty, and people that grow food. There was one Tongan lady, I think, down on the Kula'ila'i end that had like, I don't know, a huge plot of sweet potato that she was cultivating, you know? And yeah, there's drug dealers, and there's welfare moms, and there's, you know, there's people that go to work for the beach. Like, there's everybody.
So some of the homeless guys that were there, you know, they don't cut their toenails. And that's what happened to Wally, the guy that was with us. Because he had Alzheimer's, you'll forget. But then his foot wouldn't fit in his shoes because his nails were too long. So she eventually started taking care of him, cutting the nails, cutting hair, cleaning ears, shaving. So she did that to a lot of the homeless guys that we ran into. So she became kind of the healer. And then she would use like tinctures or things that was available, you know, the healing part of it. And so she became that kind of, not kahuna yet, but more like, you know, I'm interested you know, I'm getting a sense this is something. And she would do a lot of research, a lot of study, and then experiment. So Hi'iaka, that chant, became something that she was looking at, and Makua being the place of all of the healing plants and medicines. So started looking at what was growing there. And then every once in a while, she'd look, get a Hawaiian plant and taste it. You know, what was the flavor? What was it doing? Was it acidic? Was it a base? Was it, did it taste good? Or did it have a really bad reaction? So she was experimenting, and this was really part of the Chinese medicine, how they did it. So she was experiencing and exploring about discovery.
For himself, Uncle Sparky described the lack of support for soldiers returning home.
Well, this attorney who would do mediation, he'd worked with the American Indians, and he came with a really good story to help me. And it was about the warriors would go out either to do battle or they would go out hunting. And they would have a, create a certain energy, just dark energy. And when they would come back to the camp, they would have to wait outside. If they caught something, they put them there, and the women would come get them, take them in. But they couldn't go back into their house or into their community until they leveled their waters. And that's one thing the Americans and the military, when I was let go, okay, thank you very much, here's your final check, here's your paperwork, okay, later. So there is no emotional or spiritual cleansing or healing to decompress. So everybody that came back brought that kind of dark energy with us into our house, with our kids. So a lot of people ended up not able to handle and getting crazy. And not because they were crazy, it's just that there was something that they couldn't understand or heal. And there was a lot of Hawaiians that were on the beach that was going through that. And in fact, the governor said at one point, there are 10 or 12 Vietnam vets in this group, and they're prone to violence. And what that brought up to me just recently in this last month, every vet, every soldier, sailor, Marine, we're all trained killers. And when we go to combat, we bring that shit back with us. And even if you don't actually get into killing, you're just in that environment, you're always in a high state of, I don't know what the word is, like you watching, you know, expecting something to happen. So you're always under attention, even if there's not a bullet fired. So you cannot leave a war zone without being impacted. The more involved you are, the more that your soul and your body and your emotions get damaged. And we don't have that ability to heal because the process doesn't allow for that. There's no money for the healing, just for the killing training.
Makua provided a place to heal for many who had nowhere else to go, including Hawaiian veterans, without asking or receiving any support from the state. It was an organized community of mutual care.
Well, the thing is, the council, many of them went there to die. Went there because of economics, they couldn't afford. There was even a family that was out there with her kids. Social services sent them out there and said, go there, it's a safe place because they take care of each other. And it's not like other homeless communities because we had organized and everybody was taking care of each other. We had crazy people out there that would be yelling at the moon, but they had their own space. You know, they were safe and they didn't humbug anybody. Very little theft. You know, if people were hungry and they didn't have, they might go to your house and go borrow some, but they wouldn't steal everything. They would just get enough food for them. And but there were several that went to die. Several of them, the economics got so bad, they went there and they got better. And some of them ended up getting housing from that. But the policies and practice for the state is if you have a family, they cannot help you. The husband has to abandon the family for the family to get help. And now they go after the husband to repay all that stuff. So it creates this separation and it forces people to do stuff that you would not normally do. It's not a healing process. it creates this forever situation that you're constantly avoiding being caught, and you don't want to be honest. And even if the husband comes back to the family, there's a threat of him getting arrested and all of this other stuff.
Here's Uncle Sparky speaking in a documentary produced by Namakaoka Aina in 1996.
You know, we're one paycheck away from being homeless anywhere in the state. Where do we go if we make a mistake? Ends up getting people to the point of no return. Emotionally, mentally, they have no hope. So you end up having a standoff in Sand Island and getting shot. Unless something is set up like this for us to go to, the city of refuge type thing, whether as a nation or part of the sovereignty, what they're doing now is that they're practicing sovereignty. They're not waiting for it to happen, they're doing it.
But the value of this sanctuary was not seen by the state under Governor Cayetano, whose administration stigmatized the Makua Beach community as lazy, unclean, and dangerous. In 1995, the state came with a notice of eviction. The community's organizing body, called the Makua Council, led the struggle against eviction. Even though Uncle Sparky wasn't living on the beach, he became deeply involved through Auntie Leandra, using his fax machine to send out communications.
I started doing more work with the group because we'd meet almost every night, and we'd debrief what was going to happen, what was going to happen that week. And I was kind of the communications guy. So whatever was decided, I would come home, write up a press release, and then fax it to everybody. And I didn't know how to do multiple phones, so it was one at a time. You know, put the paper in, dial the number, push play, and it took me hours to do that. And over time, we were able to do video that was aired on Olelo, do press releases that got the media interested, and started telling the story, humanizing homelessness, and making it so that it wasn't something that the bias reporting from the news controlled the whole message. So we took that. We made it ours. And we just wanted to be able to take away the control from the state and make it so that we were able to participate in the process. But the state didn't want that. We met with the heads of the Democratic Party. We met with our senators, our reps, went to the legislature, talked to them, met with other Hawaiian groups. But most people are afraid of homeless. They don't want to have to deal with them. It brings us, I don't know if it's a stink or a stigma that if you get too close, it's going to rub off and I might be homeless. So there's a lot of resistance in dealing with that kind of, those conditions. But they don't mind sending the cops or the military to go ahead and deal with it forcefully, but they won't look for a long-term solution. So what we were facing over 20 years ago, and then before that was like 30 years ago, and then 40 years ago, the evictions, the arrests, nothing's changed. It's still the sweeps, it's still the same issues, and the people in control, they talk nice, but they don't really intend to really solve the problem. Otherwise, it would be done.
While the Makua Council organized against the eviction at the beach, another stream of community organizing was steadily growing around the dangers associated with the military's use of Makua Valley. Part 2, The Valley. Like Uncle Sparky, Uncle Vince's dad, Fred Dodge, was a veteran-turned-activist. Uncle Fred was Hungarian-Jewish and grew up in New Jersey. A medic in the Korean War, he met Uncle Vince's mom during R&R in Japan, where they married and had Vince before moving to the East Coast. After Uncle Fred finished medical school, the family moved to Oahu. As a resident doctor at St. Francis Hospital, Uncle Fred first encountered Makua during a company picnic at a stretch of beach called Hale Mohalu at the northern end of Makua Beach.
Hale Mohalu got its name from a place called Hale Mohalu, which is the residence that the Hansen disease patients from Molokai, from Kalaupapa, which is where they would stay when they came to Honolulu for treatment. This was a Quonset hut, big old army Quonset hut that was, you know, turned into bedrooms and whatnot, into living space, and it was in Pearl City. And that beach is on the north end of Makua Beach. And later found out that, you know, the Hansen's disease patients chose that beach because, you know, when I was so far away from everything that basically people didn't bother them, people weren't afraid of them, not many people went down there. And that, so that sort of let, that northern corner of the beach kind of was their place, and it became known as Hale Mohalo Beach. And ultimately they moved the old bus down there so they'd have some place to get out of the sun and or the rain and hang out. And so my dad said, you know, the St. Francis gang went down and ended up at that side of the beach, and as he passed Makua Valley, it just called to him. And since that time, which should have been in sometime in 1961 or early 1962, he's always been on the lookout for information about Makua, and he has files that go back probably till then, you know, of newspaper articles and magazine articles and, you know, pictures and whatnot that he saw that were about Makua.
Once a self-described hawk, Uncle Fred became an anti-war protester in the 60s, taking a young Vince to protests on the weekends. I asked Uncle Vince how his dad first got involved politically at Makua.
I think that started in 1992, because that's the first time I remember being invited to participate in a community meeting, a community dialogue with the Army. And what had come to the community's attention was that in 1992, the Army applied to the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, for a permanent permit to dispose of outdated and unwanted munitions in Makua Valley. And what we learned was that they had been doing this for decades upon decades and had destroyed, either by explosion or by burning, hundreds of tons of outdated munitions, all kinds of stuff. Also, medical waste from Triple Army Hospital, radioactive waste from the University of Hawaii. You know, it was an out of sight, out of mind, convenient place to get rid of your junk, your dangerous trash, you know. And the community was surprised and I think alarmed, and came out in force against the Army's request for permit. And ultimately, the Army withdrew their request, and they stopped doing that. And what, you know, what we, there was a study done in 1992 by a company called Halliburton. It was like an environmental assessment of contamination, particularly in one area, a 1 4-acre area called the Open Burn, Open Detonation Site, OBOD site, kind of central in the valley, about 4 acres, and they had located some contaminated hot spots there, you know, like serious soil contamination. So we were concerned. We were concerned for the well-being of our whole community, because Makua Beach is a much-loved beach. And, you know, I raised my kids there, and forever, people have been living there and camping there. I mean, Makua has always been a summer fishing village. And we know that everything that's mauka, that's upland, will eventually migrate downstream into Makua Bay, into the ocean. And we were concerned that just by being on the beach, just by swimming in the water, by eating the fish, the shellfish, the limu from Makua, that we were slowly poisoning ourselves. I think already by the 90s, you know, Waianae was identified as a community with really incredible health disparities. You know, Waianae, I don't know what it is in this moment, but through the early 2000s, mid-2000s, Waianae was like 80% Hawaiian, part Hawaiian. You know, it's like we probably have the most Hawaiian people in any community in the world here. And so we have, diabetes is at least 1/3 of the population, if not more, right? High blood pressure, heart disease, cancers, like we got it all. And it's not just the older generation. In by 2006, in Waianae Intermediate School, we were already seeing 11 and 12 year olds, 7th and 8th graders, with type 2 adult onset diabetes. You know, it's serious. So the concern that on top of that, you know, the poisoning by diet and modern diet and lifestyle, that we're getting poisoned by military toxics by going down to Makua. And of course, if Makua is contaminated, then the whole coast is contaminated because the currents go up and down and the fish go up and down, you know. So it was a big concern.
In addition to concerns about the OBOD site, another much more visible environmental impact was training-related fires in the valley. The Army's live fire training would frequently cause fires, including ones that would burn outside the firebreak road designed to limit their spread. Over a 10-year period, the Army itself counted about 270 training-related fires. Uncle Vince himself saw many of these fires while he was a commercial fisherman in the 80s.
I came to Waianae to live in 1979. And in 1980, I became a fisherman. And then I saw Makua, like, regularly, because I fished primarily on this side and often down towards Kaina Point and outside of Makua. And then I also saw the desecration of the valley, because I can remember the fires. They used to rage, used to burn the whole valley. And I fished at night mostly. So, you know, at night, the fire is beautiful. It's like the volcano on the Big Island, you know, the flames and the line of flames and whatnot. But then the day comes and then there's this blackened aina, right? And usually then the wind picks up and then the sea and the boat would just get covered with this this fine ash would rain down on us, you know? And it was sad to see that. And that was a pretty common occurrence.
Part 3, eviction. While the Army continued to train in Makua Valley, the community living at Makua Beach was organizing to fight the looming eviction. Part of that struggle was a media battle against the Cayetano administration and the mainstream media through putting out their own story on Olelo community media.
During that time, we were getting close. We knew an eviction was coming. We kept doing everything we could to prevent it. The Makua Council ended up going to the community and doing a survey. And the first one that we did, 9 out of 10 people in the community said, "You guys are bums, go get a job." And during that time, the governor was saying, you know, why should you all be going to work fighting traffic and these guys are enjoying the sun and the surf on the beach? So trying to separate and creating this animosity and permission in the communities to be very forceful, and the community would say, yeah, right on. But we had a year, and in that year, doing the video, doing the press releases, getting, you know, changing the interest of media and the community. They went out again, did another survey a year later. 9 out of the 10 people said, "You guys, right on. Keep doing what you're doing." And this is one of the things that really helped. But Olelo is the one that helped us getting a lot of that stuff on the air. So I was able to build some skills in the video component, learn how to do it. And like I said, my family paid a lot to allow that to happen, because food, tape, or gas. And that means sometimes it's a couple noodles, sometimes it's peanut butter and jelly. And we survived, but there was a price to pay to do the kind of work that we were doing.
The hard-fought media campaign helped win hearts and minds, but there was a sense of fear among some community members about the risks of supporting the Makua Council against the agenda of the state.
There was a lot of people that I talked to that says, "We want to support you guys, but we're really afraid." So I said, well, if all you can do is stay home on your couch, watch on TV, see what's happening, and send us a prayer, that's good enough. I mean, if that's all you can do, if you can, come down. If you cannot, You know, it was based on everybody's readiness to participate.
On June 18th, 1996, state forces came in to evict the community from the beach, arresting 16 people, including Uncle Sparky, and bulldozing the homes there. As has been the case in other struggles, it was Hawaiian police, including family members of Uncle Sparky, who were sent to arrest Hawaiians at Makua Beach.
I seen family members that stayed away from where I was, but I seen them on a peripheral doing their job as a sheriff. And the attorney general that was along with them was after him, get in there and arrest these guys, yank them by the hair, whatever. I mean, he was really pissed off because you send Hawaiian sheriffs to go arrest Hawaiian people that are homeless. The only way they do it is by getting them pissed off. So most of the guys, the sheriffs that were there, they're pissed. They didn't want to be there, and they're being forced. Fortunately, they arrested us, and if they did it on like Friday, we would have to have stayed until Monday. But they picked a weekday, so it was like the next day. But my niece was a sheriff, the female, so all the women that got arrested, like one of the Wahinis, she said, they said, what's your name? And she said, Hapai Lahu. Which was funny because that means she would castrate. She was a castrator. Anyway, that, and you know, going there and meeting my niece, and said, Uncle, what are you doing here? And my brother was in charge, was in the sheriff's department. It was all the sheriff's guys. And he was in charge of communication for the whole action that was out here. So that was kind of the arrest. And then, you know, after the arrest, we go through the court. And we had not only the ones that was arrested, but we had support group. You know, they were outside the courts with signs protesting. And then they were all in the court being present as we were being tried. And it wasn't even a trial yet. It was just, okay, we're going to release you. So that was kind of the stuff. But there was support. It wasn't, we were not alone. And that made a huge difference.
As the 16 people arrested at Makua and their supporters were busy in court, it became clear who had been pushing for the eviction at the beach.
We found that the military, because they had been nice, they give us sea rations, they would come talk to us, make sure that we were okay, all that bullshit PR stuff. Then we found out they were actually behind it. So we pushed because we wanted to have a long-term solution to homelessness. And we ended up at Camp Smith, third or fourth floor, this huge, monstrous table that has microphones and cameras and all of this stuff. The admirals, we had a four-star admiral on the table, and then it was us, Malama Makua. The governor was pissed because they put him on an outside ring. Even Oha Magazine was there. They were an outside ring, but they were observing. We were on the inside ring talking about how important the land is there because it's also a spawning ground for a lot of the stuff that we would eat. And the food, and it's downwind from all of these things that the Army says, no, it stops at the fence. They say, that's just routine training. Yeah, there's no such thing as routine training. Because I remember seeing jets coming in, they would fire from the shore, and all kinds of stuff. But trying to understand where the source of forcing the state, rather than solving the problem, creating it where you clear the beach. The Marines came, they wanted to do an amphibious landing over the area where Israel, Kamakavivo, all these ashes was just scattered. So this is all within like 30, 60 days. Israel passed, scattered the ashes at Makua. Thousands show up. Traffic is backed up all the way to Ko'olina side. And they wanted to do an amphibious landing. We were able to stop that. But they still did a landing with helicopters. But they didn't do it from the ocean. So more and more, now we've got the Makua Council, and then we got Fred Guys, which is the Peace and Justice, Gigi Kokio, Sister McInerney. There's a whole bunch of community members, Peace and Justice. here we got low people that don't know nothing about what we're doing or why we're doing it, other than the Aina is calling us, and we meet at the front gate. That's when we solidified Malama Makua.
And so Malama Makua was born as two streams of activism flowed together. The Makua Council fighting for Hawaiians' access to land to live and heal, and peace activists protesting the impacts of military training. As the two groups met at the gate outside Makua Valley.
That was the beginning.
In the next episode of Makua Pico of Peace, we enter Makua Valley on cultural access to connect with the valley and hear about Malama Makua's legal battles with the army. Before Us is a podcast produced by me, Kenji Cataldo. The series, Makua Pico of Peace, is produced in collaboration with Malama Makua. A big thank you today to Uncle Sparky Rodriguez and Uncle Vince Dodge for sharing their stories, and to Namakaoka Aina for the use of audio from their documentary, Makua to Heal the Nation. The theme music was created by No Drama. Thank you for listening. Ahui ho!